good. Okay, well, welcome, everybody. This is the November Citizens Climate Lobby call. What's going to be happening is, in just a moment, I'm going to be having Danny Richter introduce our speaker and interview him. Hopefully, there'll be time for questions from the field. If there are, we'll start in Tri-Cities, then Roaring Forks, Colorado, then Edina, Minnesota, and then Portland. We'll see. It always depends on time. After that, we're going to get reports from the field. There are a lot of really remarkable things happening, and I know a lot of people were excited that we have been inching oh so closely towards, will we have got our 1,000th letter to the editor by the time this call happens, and we'll find out from Amy Bennett in just a little bit. Then we'll go over the U.S. actions. Steve Balk will read those, and Kathy will read the Canadian actions. And it's fitting that we are making another run in the faith-based arena. I'm actually in Austin, Texas today. At this very moment, I'm in the living room of Susan Adams, who's one of the co-leaders of the Austin group. We're having the Austin Regional Conference. And our speaker right now who's speaking while I'm on the call is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. And I think people remember, who are familiar with the work that Dr. Hayhoe did with us, that that was one of the moments that, in my view, really changed our organization. Sometimes you talk to people and they tell you, you know, you're being small-minded or petty or not as big as you could be about an issue. And when people say things like that to me, I usually say something back, well, you're small-minded and petty and you have bad breath, but you're probably a worse person than I am. Well, what happened when Dr. Hayhoe worked with us was it became obvious to me that the only portal that I was letting people work with me on this issue were people who came to me scientifically. And what she said was there was this huge swath of the country that wanted to help, but the basis they wanted to help was the basis of their faith. What that made obvious to me was not only was faith possibly an issue, but there are a lot of other ways people came to the issue that wasn't through the scientific avenue that wanted to help, and that if we only took the smallest view of things, which is people could work on this, if they worked on it on our terms, we were really going to limit our ability to influence what we needed to influence. So I think it's a real gift when people don't tell you you're being small-minded, but they work with you in a way where you see for yourself that you're small-minded. And I think it's kind of fitting that Dr. Hayhoe's here with us in Austin, and that we're taking another cut at the faith-based avenue again in this month's actions. You know, I do firmly believe that more often than not, messenger is more important than message. And the more people we draw into this to work with us on solving the problem that are outside of traditional green or traditional clean, the better chance we have at success. So what's going to happen is I'm going to ask Danny Richter, our Director of Science and Legislation, to introduce and interview our speaker. And again, after that, we'll get to some of our reports from the field and then go over this month's actions. And then I'll be returning to the Austin conference. There's a little bit of issues we need to work with. I'm using Susan's living room, and she gave me her key to get into her house during the conference, which is in a meeting room, and I broke the key off in the front door. So hopefully figure out how to do the call, get the key out of the door, and get back to the conference, finish the regional conference. But nevertheless, I'm sure we'll do all the things we need to do to have this call be successful. So, Danny, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Danny, can you go ahead and introduce our speaker, and then go ahead and get us going here?
I will be happy to. Eric Sapp is our speaker, and he has spent much of his career focused on the intersection of faith and politics. He is a founding partner of Eliaison Group, which is a full-service consulting firm operating on the belief that it is possible to align what is right with what works politically and economically, and that doing so is the most effective way to bring about positive and lasting change. He is also serving as the executive director of the American Values Network, a faith and values-based nonprofit that has received significant recognition in the last few years for its successful media campaigns targeting faith, veterans, and independent voters on climate, national security, and economic justice issues. Eric was born in Durham, North Carolina, and grew up in South Florida. He has his Master's of Divinity and Master of Public Policy from Duke University, and he now lives in Northern Virginia with his high school sweetheart, Julie, and their son, Beckett. And if you are not yet sufficiently impressed, Eric is also a woodworker and started keeping bees last year. I believe that makes him the first apiarist that we have had on this call. So I think you should devote your full and undivided attention to what he has to say next. So, Eric, take it away.
Well, thank you, Danny and Mark. When they asked me to come, I was really excited because what all of you on this call are doing is so vitally important, and it is all the more laudable in this last year as a lot of attention has moved elsewhere within the progressive community. As we're seeing the victories we've seen with kind of EPA regulations and other things, that is all owed to you and the continued dedication to this vital issue. So I want to just thank you and how honored and excited I am. What Danny asked me to talk about two things today, so I'm going to take about 15 minutes to talk about, first, faith outreach, how it works, how it has worked well. I'm going to give a few little facts, but mostly tell stories to try to put some meat on the bone for you all, and then take a few minutes at the end, too. We were very intimately involved in the climate bill debate of 2009, and sometimes I think the narrative of what happens there can get a little skewed, and so just to give you my take on what happened and why the 2009 bill didn't make it, and in a way kind of point a path forward to how we bring back some of these national issues again. So let me start first to just give you my background and how I came into climate, because it's important and will inform kind of my entire perspective. I come at all these issues. I'm a Christian. I'm an evangelical Christian. I got into the work that I'm doing because I was worried about what I saw happening to the Christian witness as it became lined up entirely with the ideology of a single party. And so our work and my entree into climate actually began after the 2004 election, when we ended up doing basically all of the Democratic faith outreach work in that following cycle, 2005 into 2006. And what we found was climate was our best way in to all these churches that Democrats had honestly never spoken to previously. We had no relationships with evangelicals. As everybody knows, the God Gap year in 2004, the best indication a person was going to vote for George W. Bush was not that they were a Republican, but that they went to church on a regular basis. And that's what kind of got Democrats' attention. But that happened because Democrats hadn't been talking to them. So we were trying to build relationships in 2006 and very quickly realized there was this point we could connect on with climate, what became, you know, creation care, environmental stewardship. That's the way that it's referred to in many faith circles. And connecting there opened doors, opened relationships. And as groups started to talk about climate and national leaders started to talk about climate, they changed some of the voting dynamics, because many voters who'd been told previously the only things that matter are abortion and gay marriage were now being told by their leaders at the top, you know, even the Catholic Church and the National Association of Evangelicals, major pastors, Rick Warren, even Pat Robertson, saying that climate change was a vital issue that Christians needed to care about, and that opened the door for a broader discussion. Now, why does this matter? Again, just some of the stats. The reason the faith community is important to this debate and how they can be so helpful in all that we're trying to do on climate is just shy of 30% of voters self-identify as evangelical. About a quarter of voters self-identify as Catholic. Another 18% will self-identify what we call mainline Protestant. Most of the Protestant churches that folks are familiar with, Presbyterian, Methodist, UCC, Episcopal, etc. All of those people, as with all people, they are more than their faith, but their faith will oftentimes heavily inform how they view themselves and the world, so being able to connect to them through that faith is vitally important. We have just completed some polling trying to figure out the best way to engage faith folks, and it it pointed out two really interesting points, and Mark kind of alluded to this at the beginning. Where a lot of us start is, well, the science is so overwhelming, and it's, you know, 99% of scientists, et cetera, agree. We know the science is clear on climate change, and so that's where a lot of us want to start. What we found in the polling that was so interesting was that the top two arguments for the whole population, for people who are not religious, and for religious people are all the same top two arguments. The science argument, the kind of 99% of science, and then the second argument being that we have a moral responsibility to tackle climate change. Are other people here?
Yes, we are.
I will just keep trying to talk over it. And what's interesting about the poll was for non-religious people, the science argument was most important. For religious people, that moral frame was most important. But for religious people, the science argument was the second most important argument. And it worked when the entree was the moral frame. So when you started in the faith community saying science, 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 and that's it, you wouldn't move people as far. But if you started with the moral argument, you met them where they were, the science argument worked very well and worked much more strongly. And when you combine those two arguments, those are arguments that persuade over 90% of Americans. And having done a lot of polling on a lot of different issues, and our pollster too, when he said this, we never see numbers like that where you have only two messages that are so simple and clear that have such a wide impact. And so this is kind of the opportunity and what's so exciting about where we are. Now, I will caveat that with, they work with all people. That doesn't mean that saying those two things, everyone's going to say, okay, I'm a climate voter only, and that's all I care about. But we will be able to bring them along on climate, and these are people, again, as Mark said at the beginning, who matter politically. A lot of the faith community, these will be swing voters. These are voters who can get into Republican circles in places where often we cannot. And so that's the opportunity we have in engaging these communities. And so I'm going to tell some stories now, just kind of experiences I've had that highlight that, and hopefully will help you all kind of see more clearly opportunities in your own communities. First example was we worked with Bob Casey in 06, running against Rick Santorum, one of many of our favorite former senators. And in that race, again, we recognized very early on we could not beat Santorum without dealing with the faith issue. And if Santorum carried the same faith numbers he had in his first election, we didn't stand a chance. So we ran a very concerted, significant faith outreach program. Again, climate being one of the biggest issues. We got the National Association of Evangelicals came on board and agreed to host an event at Messiah College, which is the big evangelical flagship school in central Pennsylvania, on climate. Invited both candidates to come, and Messiah hosted it. They had students, they had faculty on the panel. Santorum refused to come. Casey showed up. Casey shows up, and again, put yourself in 2005, what had just happened in the election, Democrats terrified to go into, this is a right-wing evangelical conservative school. The new Democratic candidate walks in. He walks into a standing ovation, is able to give a speech, you know, without any opposition on the importance of being a good steward of the environment, talks about how this is going to be one of the key issues on his campaign. The first question from the students, directed at him, but why was Rick Santorum afraid to show up here today and talk about this? And it kind of just got better from there. When Casey left that meeting, he said this a number of times after the election, he was obviously running because he thought he could win. That was the first time that he truly believed he was going to win and saw the path forward, and it was all because of climate and this response that he was not expecting from a community that had generally been considered Republican stronghold. Jump over a little bit to Michigan. Governor Granholm, who's running against Dick DeVos, and she held an event to give a talk. We had a talk at another of the evangelical flagship schools that was in DeVos's hometown. We actually met in the auditorium that was named after his family. He had done the Amway stuff, and they'd given all this money. So we were having an event in an auditorium named after our opponent at this school. The campaign was so worried about this that they actually did not put out a press release about the event. They didn't know. They were worried about what the response was going to be. Granholm again went. The main point of her talk, the main connecting place, was Creation Care. She walks into a standing ovation from the entire audience. There are a bunch of religious media there, and the press and the religious media in Western Michigan was overwhelmingly positive, glowing, talking about how strong the response was from the students. This happened about a week and a half before the election, and Dick DeVos changed his schedule at the end of the election to come back to his hometown and spent the last 3 days of the election not campaigning in battleground state places around the state, but campaigning back in his hometown because his campaign was so worried about what had happened when Granholm was able to connect on climate change. Last example from 2006, kick us over to Kansas. A state senator named Raj Goyal, and this is for people who are like, well, you know, Bob Casey was pro-life, Granholm was pro-choice, but a strong Christian. You're like, well, how do I do this if maybe I'm not a Christian? I don't go to church all the time. Raj Goyal was a Hindu. He was running in Wichita, Kansas, in a heavily white evangelical district against a white evangelical incumbent. He beat that incumbent. And he wrote us afterwards. We worked with him. We worked with Sebelius. We were doing a lot of climate work, working with nuns and others in the state. He wrote us afterwards and said the reason he won was this issue and all the outreach he did through it. He met people where they were. He reached out to the faith community. Again, as Mark said, he didn't tell them why they were wrong or tell them why they needed to believe what he believed. Instead, he sought to understand why they believed what they believed and find ways to connect. And you had a Hindu in Wichita, Kansas, beat an incumbent white evangelical in 2006, again on this issue. And these results were carried, you know, in many places around the country. In 2006, candidates whom we worked with who did the faith outreach, again with climate being the key issue, was kind of our gateway drug, they performed 20 points better than the other Democrats with white Protestants, and in an election where we made big gains with Catholics, they outperformed other Democrats by 10 points with Catholics. It was a huge, huge shift that we saw. That's what kind of got the party's attention on a lot of these issues and bumped, in a certain extent, climate up, but also the faith outreach up in the party from 2006 to 2008. And one other point that I think is really important looking at the 2006 time. This was an area, and this is where I'll go, you know, to people who say, oh, well, you know, and just in general on the faith outreach side, maybe it's where we work with candidates that aren't as strong Democrats, et cetera. If you went around the country and worked with a bunch of candidates, the only candidates who ran ads on climate in 2006, and in a similar vein, the only candidates who talked explicitly about poverty in 2006 were candidates involved in faith outreach. And the Democratic candidates involved in faith outreach. Lots of people had, you know, they had the checkbox on their website. They'd fill out the voter things and send them back to the groups. And, you know, and Democrats were good on this. But the people that ran on it, the faith part was what did it. And that's where this coalition with faith voters can be so significant to us. It creates another political lever that matters to the people we are trying to influence. Two other case studies taking it to 2008, and this kind of from the advocacy side. Harry Reid running for re-election, but early on we were trying to raise up climate as an issue with him, trying to get him to champion it. Obviously, you had the bill now moving through through Congress, past the House, going to the Senate, and so we've done a lot of organizing in Nevada on faith outreach, explicitly around climate, and set up a teletown hall. We talked to Senator Reid. It took us like 6 months to get him to agree to it. Set up a teletown hall on the moral and national security implications of climate change. Through our outreach, through engaging these churches, pastors, we had a person on the ground. We worked with a number of climate groups in Nevada to build this up. We had 20,000 people call in to this teletown hall with Senator Reid on the moral and national security implications of climate. The most they'd ever had on a teletown hall before was 3,000 people. This happened the same day that Sarah Palin kicked off her national tour out of Harry Reid's hometown, and they were able to run all these ads that Sarah Palin had a crowd of 500. We had 20,000 people call into us. And at this point, I was working exclusively on the advocacy side. We weren't doing the political work in that race. And we've been trying to get them on the climate bill, trying to get attention. And it's a classic thing, but, you know, you make calls, it takes a while to get back, et cetera. For the rest of the year, if I called their political director, I'd have a call back in 5 minutes because we delivered something that they valued. Last example, because this segues me in on the climate bill case study. In 2008, we were the lead consultant for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's Red to Blue program. So we worked with all the pickup opportunities that Democrats thought they'd have in 2008. Over 40 of our candidates won in that program. Many of them, in very red districts, all of them doing faith outreach, and all of them leading with climate because that was our connecting point to connect with these people. Again, it brought a huge swing of Democrats into Congress. Another example at the Senate level, Senator Hagan in 2008, and this is an interesting one too because obviously Hagan's North Carolina, and she was running. The Obama campaign actually shut down all of their faith outreach programs in North Carolina. So there was nothing happening at OFA on faith in North Carolina. Hagan was the only one doing it. She was, again, climate was the lead on everything she was doing. And Senator Hagan in 2008, Obama's big year, she outperformed Obama by 10 points with evangelical voters of all races. And then I think it was like 5 or 6 points with Catholic voters in the state. So again, engaging in these issues was something that worked. Now, I'll take the last 2 minutes just to explain why a lot of us, we look back on the climate bill, and it's obviously a sore point. It was something that thought was so close and didn't come to fruition. As I said, we had been working with, when the climate bill kicked off in 2009, there were over 50 members of Congress who had been our former clients, most of them in swing districts. So we knew them, were engaging them very directly, and had a very open conversation with them. As the bill moved forward, we also, CEW, which many of you will remember, kind of the coalition of climate groups, began to realize that actually the moral and national security arguments were the most resonant in this debate, and especially in the members that we needed to swing. And so towards the end of the debate, they actually ran almost all of their paid media through American Values Network, where we would team up pastors and generals and ads at events, et cetera, just to create this frame. And what would happen would be we'd have a lot of the climate community show up. We'd frame our issues in terms of our values and our security, and it was just a way to build it. A lot of people look back and say, oh, the bill failed, you know, lots of reasons. Having been on the inside, my very strong experience and diagnosis is what happened, because we were watching it and counting the votes. We had a bunch of Democrats in the House lined up. We had a big majority to pass the bill. As you all may remember, 3 weeks before the vote in the House, the word came down from the White House to all of our allies, now's the time to push for Obamacare. And there was a massive swing. And as progressives who cared both about health care and climate shifted their focus, the groups that were fighting us on climate didn't care that much about health care. The coal companies and others were able to keep their pressure going. Lobbyists were flooding from them while our side turned its attention to Obamacare. And we lost in the last 3 weeks. I remember talking to one office where they said their call volume had been been equal, letters have been equal, requests for events have been equal, and then the last 2 weeks after that shift happened, they went to 5-1 against. That was one of the offices that we lost. So all of a sudden, we go from this huge momentum in the House, where we're probably going to win by 40 or more votes. A lot of them slip away. We still pass it in the House, but we don't pass it by the same major majorities. And instead of getting the bill done in the Senate that had already been passed in the House, had the momentum, and would have addressed the biggest issue of the time of economics, turned instead to health care. And that had a double whammy because it killed the momentum of the climate bill going into the Senate, but it also, all of my former clients who were in these swing districts who'd taken a hard vote for them on climate, you know, on the president's bill, backing the bill, knowing they could take hits, but also believing if the bill was passed, they'd win in the end because they could show the outcomes, they could show the jobs, show these other things, saw them being asked to take a controversial vote and then being left hanging because it wasn't pushed to the Senate as they were promised. And a lot of those members then, for that reason, refused to back Obamacare, which killed its momentum, slowed it down, and we just then jumbled everything going forward into the Senate. And so when people ask what happened, it was not the merits of the bill, in my opinion, having seen it on the inside, that did it. It was honestly a strategic mistake and the impact that that had on momentum going into the Senate, and then the chilling effect it had on House members supporting Obamacare, which then cycled back to further slowing the climate bill and the Senate. So those are my stories. That's my perspective, and I will pause there and open to questions you might have.
All right, Eric, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. The stories were great, and that is what I was hoping you could tell us about. I found it inspiring to know that members of Congress can win by talking about the climate, and I think that your stories illustrated that very clearly. So thank you so much. Before we get to questions, I'll let Mark jump in if we run out of time. But I wanted you to give some quick pointers as our volunteers go out and begin making appointments with their faith leaders to talk about climate in their faith communities. Do you have any tips for them for how to begin that conversation or how to go out and do that?
Yeah. Well, the most important one is begin the conversation. I think, and it can be scary at times, but I think you will find in the vast majority of spaces just starting the conversation is the most important part because you share so much in common with this community. And when you do start it, make it more of a listening conversation than a pitching one. I often, just broadly in communication, so often we approach things thinking, how do we win an argument? How do we convince people? And I'd say, think of all our outreach more, not as a terms of an argument, but as wooing. So kind of look at it more as a date instead of a debate. And kind of approaching in that mindset oftentimes will change the way that we approach people and communities in a positive manner. I'll put in a quick plug, just resource-wise, if you go to American Values Network, the climate tab, we have a ton of resources, quotes from famous Christian leaders that you can use to buttress your points, talking point guides. We have the most exhaustive, kind of exegetical, detailed analysis of what everything the Bible says in a bunch of different ways on environmental stewardship. So that's a way if you want to go a little deeper and get more resources, that's another place you can go. And then finally, just at the most basic level, as we've seen, you know, from this polling, engage people on the fact that we have a moral responsibility to be good stewards of God's creation. And, you know, stewardship, I'll often use this, again, this can fit whether you're religious or not, is we have responsibility to care for what we have been given. I mean, to care for this earth, however you want, however, is authentic. Be authentic. Never try to pretend to be something you're not. So whether it's creation, whether it's the earth, whatever it is, we have a responsibility to be stewards of what we have. not just because we have it, but because we hold it in trust for future generations. And this idea of stewardship, you know, in a Christian sense, we are responsible to take care of what God has given us, and we are stewards to hold that for the generations that come afterwards. That's a very easy and effective way to connect with people. And then something else we saw from the poll, talking about the impact of climate change on the least of these, on the poorest of the poor, those who contribute the least to the problem and pay the greatest consequence, is also a kind of basic frame that resonates quite well in broad faith circles, especially in conservative ones where there's such a thrust towards international missions. Many people have been overseas in third world countries on international missions. They now know those people. They can put a face on the folks who are being affected by this, and the more you can personalize it, the better.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thank you. We will put, thank you for the plug. We'll put that up on our website. We've been collecting resources that our volunteers can go to, so we'll throw that in there with the rest of them. Thank you, Mark. Do we have time for questions, or do we need to move on?
No, we're gonna have to invite you back for questions, because that was riveting and on multiple levels. Again, you know, I'm really glad that we're approaching this from the angle of the faith-based approach. It's something where, you know, we're not the kind of organization that does something once. You know, the old Roadrunner cartoon, you know, he never gets caught, but Wile E. Coyote only tries something once and then goes on to the next thing.
Yep.
You know, we're the kind of organization that when we find something, we're going to do it over and over and over again until we actually get the result we're looking for. So
that was great.
Very, very poignant on that level. But also, you know, when Waxman Markey was underway, we had six groups. Now, we thought we were a force to be reckoned with six groups and 25 volunteers. but it's a little bit different now with 141 groups and over 3,500
yes.
volunteers. And that, you know, it's just something we're going to have to know is there's going to be a point where there's going to be a viable opportunity to get a bill passed, then how important it is for us to be able to support member by member, for them to know back home in the district, there are people that are going to do everything they can to make sure they can make it a courageous vote. So that was really, really remarkable, and we are extremely grateful you could be on, and hopefully you could come back to answer some questions in the future.
Well, my pleasure, and again, it's so exciting, and I'm so grateful for all the work that you and your very broad and continually growing community does. And maybe the last thing I'll just throw, you know, if people are interested, if you're really kind of lost or scared, you know, obviously Mark and Danny can pass questions on, but we're happy to answer questions folks have on their own, and we may know people and, you know, may know good allies in the faith community where you are. So we very happy through American Values Network or Good Steward Campaign is our specific climate campaign. We have staff and connections, so always happy to be a resource to anyone who's trying to do this work.
Great. Thank you again so much. Again, this was fantastic, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to get you back and not only take advantage of your resources, but get you back on so that they can ask more detailed questions and continue to apply into it. And I know it's a Saturday and you're busy, but if you can stay on for the next 20 or 25 minutes to hear the kind of things people are doing, I think it'll be worth your while.
I will, and I look forward to it.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to start then with just the general reports of some of the things that happened across the board for the organization, then we'll get into a couple of specific reports. So, first of all, Amy, are you there?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
I am there. So, Amy, we've all been super excited and kind of on pins and needles of, where were we on 1,000 letters to the editor for the year, and we were at 998 last night. Where are we in terms of the number of letters to the editor Citizens Climate Lobby has published this year to date?
As of this morning, Mark, it is 1,001.
Okay, great. All right, so congratulations, everybody. That's one thing. I mean, you know, obviously the number's not important. What is more important is obviously the overall effort everybody's been making. And that is fantastic news. It was going to take us producing the most letters to the editor we've ever produced in a month to get, which was going to be 127, to get to 1,000. So that means we've done at least 128. So that's fantastic. One of the ones I noticed, I was in Colorado 2 weeks ago starting a brand new group, and I was looking through the Aspen Times to see if there's anything in the paper that would show me what people should look for to write letters to the editor. And of course, there was a letter from none other than Judy Weiss, our rabbi from Boston, who's our most prolific writer. And I guess what I would have been surprised is not that there was a letter, but if there hadn't been a letter from Judy Weiss, I probably should have been surprised. And then, Amy, what about in terms of op-eds? How many op-eds do we have month to date?
This was a big month, Mark. We had 23 op-eds.
That is big, and that's just one of our highest months, everybody. And again, that's not like let's just think, oh, an op-ed got printed. If you look at the quality of pieces our people write, they are impactful one after another. One of the ones I loved, I'm going to read you just the opening paragraph. Dave Folland is a retired pediatrician from Salt Lake City, and he opened his op-ed with, "For a state without a lottery, horse betting, or slot machines, it's surprising that the majority of our state and federal representatives are gambling with our future. They're gambling that fossil fuels, especially tar sands, will be the fuel of the future, and that the continued use of them will not harm us. We buckle up our children in sturdy car seats, yet with our children's future, as if we're tossing them in the back of the pickup with no restraint." So that's just an example of the kind of great pieces we had. One of the ones that I love, you've seen the piece that we had about the op-ed that we've circulated in multiple papers about the coal miner who lost his job but then got a job as a solar installer in St. Louis. Well, that got picked up by the Pittsburgh Gazette. At the end of that piece, which is nice because it's right in the heart of coal country again, at the end of that piece, we don't talk about fee and dividend, but we talk about the economists that support a tax shift. While I always recommend to people that they never read the online comments, because there was only one, I read the online comment, and what it says is, this sounds like a really good idea, but a dividend would be better. So that was kind of nice seeing that comment. The last thought that I want to mention is, before we even got the Tri-Cities chapter up, Alex and her team got an op-ed in the paper, and what was really lovely about it is her just telling the story, that she knew the paper said it was going to run. She couldn't sleep the night before, but then finally she hears the paper drop in her front yard about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, runs out, and sure enough, there it is. So 24 is just a number, but every one of those well-written and impactful in the community, and that is just fantastic. Okay, so then, Amy, let's shift over to some of the specific reports, okay?
Yes.
Okay, so first of all, Joe Robertson, you're part of an effort. We've been reaching out to the World Bank for years. What we've been asking them to do is to stop financing coal-fired plants, and thank goodness they've now come and said, if unless there is absolutely no other option, the World Bank is not going to fund coal-fired plants anymore. And Joe, can you tell us about what else has happened? Then you're going to have to *6 your phone to unmute it. Well, Amy, you're still there, right?
I am.
Okay, good. Well, let's go on to your report, because you've got a report this month also. Go ahead.
Oh, is that Joe?
Oh, no, hold on. There's Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
So we've been lobbying the World Bank for a few years now. Kathy Orlando did some really great work building relationships there. We've been asking them to stop funding coal projects. And this summer they announced that they're going to stop funding new coal projects. They haven't completely eliminated funding, but there's a lot of talk about that a couple of weeks ago at the Civil Society Forum, and they're going to get there. We presented the CCL model and carbon fee and dividend as a stakeholder-centered approach to pricing carbon and moving away from fossil fuels worldwide, scalable through the border adjustment, easy for nations to adopt without a global treaty. They asked us to come back for the spring sessions. And we're talking to the organizer of the Civil Society Forum about doing two sessions instead of one. One where we'll advise the executive directors of the World Bank and IMF about how to implement this kind of policy. And another where we will actually have a roundtable with practitioners who are already putting some of these new technologies into effect in the developing world.
Great. Congratulations to Joe, the rest of the team, Danny, Siren, Erica. Must have done a fantastic job that they're asking you back already. All right, stay with us, Joe, because we'll need you again in a minute here. So, Amy, you've been working on something that you wanted to report also, right?
Yes, that's right, Mark. This started back in 2011 when Pope Benedict was very concerned about climate change, and the scientific branch of the Vatican, the Pontifical Academy, produced the report on the fate of the mountain glaciers in the Anthropocene. CCL spotted this back in 2011, and so I reached out to I reached out to the Pontifical Academy to ask for permission to share that report with Congress at our conference in Washington, D.C. that year. And the day that I reached out to them, the very same day, I got an email back from the Chancellor of the Pontifical Academy assuring us that we could use the report. Copied in that email back to me was the Pontifical Academy President, Professor Werner Arbour, who's a Nobel laureate in biology. And the Chancellor emphasized the Holy Father's interest, and he said, I quote, "He speaks of climate issues in almost all of his main addresses." Mark, I think you remember when I called you and I was so excited about that.
I do remember, Amy. I can remember actually getting the email and seeing something from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. I was in the lobby of a hotel in San Francisco, and I literally stood there and shook for about 5 minutes because it made such an impact on me. It was so something I wasn't expecting to see on my cell phone on a Saturday morning in San Francisco. Go ahead, Amy.
And Mark, did you know that 163 members of Congress are Catholic? That's more than 30%. This year we have a new Pope, Pope Francis, and I observe that he's pretty forward-thinking and stepping out in a lot of new ways that a lot of us have noticed. He's actually even personally called people who have written him letters. So I started researching his speeches and his approach, and especially in regard to the poor and the vulnerable. So this September, I reached out again to the Chancellor with our CCL method, with praise and admirations for the cool things that the Pope was doing, and I included an update about our growth since we last spoke. And I asked specifically, would the Holy Father consider a short call to our group on a conference call to offer encouragement? CCL volunteers work tirelessly and respectfully to speak the truth to those with great resources and power. If the Holy Father speaks to CCL volunteers, it would send a powerful message to our leaders in Washington, D.C. So I didn't receive a response for several weeks, but in CCL fashion, I sent another email asking the Chancellor if he had received my previous email, and I got a reply the very next day. He said, "As you will understand, Pope Francis can't call everybody and normally decides who to call following his instinct to favor the poor." The Chancellor went on. "However, an opportunity to study this problem will come in our workshop on sustainable humanity next year." He continued, "Perhaps the Pope will call someone in the field after the workshop. Since I cannot mediate for you," he suggested, "please write to His Holiness directly." And then he continued, "It would be easier if you write to him in Spanish, no more than half a page." And then he gave me an address for the Pope that I have not been able to find anywhere else. So that is where we are today. And Joseph Roberts.
So you have the Pope's. You have the Pope's email address, huh, Amy?
No, it's actually a literal mailing address, but it is one that I haven't found anyplace else. So I'm keeping it.
Yeah. So Joe Robertson, you're our official Spanish translator. How is the letter coming, Joe?
I'll just read a little bit of it to you. Santísimo Padre, Papa Francisco. Quisiéramos agradecerle su liderazgo moral y trascendente del asunto ético más importante de nuestro tiempo, la desestabilización del sistema climático. El lobby ciudadano por el clima consta de más de 3.500 voluntarios en Estados Unidos, Canadá y Europa, trabajando para inspirar y aumentar la voluntad política por un precio sobre el carbono y una transición limpia hacia la justicia climática.
The only part I picked up, Joe, is I think that you said you like that he doesn't wear those red shoes. Is that the part I got right?
I did say that, yeah.
Mark, this is Amy.
Yes.
One of the things that we're going to do is suggest that Papa Francesco contact CCL to encourage and support us, but specifically to support us with an invitation for Congress to attend that Vatican conference. And that would not only be life-changing for members of Congress, but it would break down barriers and partisanship and open doors. It could change the conversation from resistance to solutions, such as the fee and dividends. So it's pretty exciting.
Great. And then, Joe, we'll ask you to get the Spanish and the English version. Thank you so much for doing that. It sounded so much better in Spanish than it would have been in English. That was fantastic. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. All right, we still have two other reports that we want to hear from. Barbara Wilson, if you could unmute your phone, if you could star six it, and just tell the people about what you envisioned. You had your Stanford College reunion coming up, and you thought, well, I could do something interesting here. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. When I saw to my horror that there was nothing on the official Stanford alumni reunion schedule related to climate change, I said, this is not okay. So got to work very, very late to the party, but this is what I have learned so far. This is taking a lot of my time to unpack. But the pros were it was time to focus attention on this very emotionally trying issue of our time. It was the time to build allies amongst individuals, many of whom are relatively well-heeled, connected, and not in the most taxing time of their lives. They're not raising their families anymore. They're thinking about their grandchildren and their legacies. That was the bulk of the audience. It provided an opportunity to work with local allies. Chief among them was Kate Gordon, who is Director of Climate and Energy at Tom Steyer's NGO called Next Generation. She must have been impressed with Mark, who was a participant in the panel, which consisted of three Stanford very, very highly renowned climate folks in economics, in law, and also an ecologist. In fact, one of the people that we had to fire from the panel because we had too many people had just received a MacArthur Fund fellowship the day after we fired him from the panel. Everybody was really, really dazzled by Kate, who we've been wooing for the last many months in order to interest Tom Steyer, a very important person written up in the September 16th issue of The New Yorker. It provided us an opportunity to become known at Stanford University and to all the outreach I did and others did to foundation heads and other NGO heads. I'm available to talk about this with anybody who would like to listen, and I will be giving a report, writing a report. The cons were, I would say, it took a lot of time. Even though it could be used to stimulate chapters in those college towns where these reunions occur, and every college has a reunion, so this was really what we call a little bet, a small pilot. I think also the con would be that it takes a lot more time than an hour and a half panel to introduce people to Citizens Climate Lobby and what a carbon fee and dividend could actually be. I think we also have to note that we're in the Bay Area and our thrust is really focused, I would say, more on people on the conservative side of things. Most of the people in the audience were center or left-leaning, and I think we have to actually speak to those folks when we're in that area. So be aware of who your audience is.
Great, Barbara. That was so great. And again, the beautiful thing I love it is every time someone does like this, takes some initiative and says, we could actually have a CCL event at my alumni reunion, other people will start to think the same thing. So thank you so much for being a trailblazer. Okay, then let's switch to Adrian in New York. What's happening back there in New York since the last call, Adrian?
Okay, so at the last call, I heard Marshall Saunders and Dick Smith talk about reaching out to the chief of staff of a Republican governor. You can hear me, Mark, can't you?
Yes, we can, Adrian. Thanks.
Okay. And I was totally inspired by that and stopped the call and decided to call City Hall and reach out to Mayor Bloomberg. And I eventually got through to his Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability. This is the Plan YC office. And after three attempts, talked to his sustainability chief, Sergei Manofsky, and he agreed to give us a one-hour meeting to do a presentation on a carbon tax and Citizens Climate Lobby. So Joe Robertson, Roger Street, and I got together three times. We prepared like a PowerPoint presentation about 45 minutes long. A couple weeks ago, we did our presentation to 4 staff members in the office. They were very impressed with the work that we are doing. You guys should be very proud of yourselves. They said that we had a very elegant approach and we were a well-oiled machine. And they agreed to bring our request back to Mayor Bloomberg, which is a face-to-face meeting with him. They told us to give them a written proposal that they could bring back. And we are right now, we've given them the proposal and we're in the process of hearing back from them.
Great. So again, that just there's 2 major themes that I wanted to point to in today's call. One is the reaching out on the faith-based again and again and again, and the other is thinking big. We all want to think as big as we can. So, you know, Joe Robertson is a humanities professor at Villanova. He teaches Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but because he thinks big, he presents at the World Bank. And Amy, reaching out to the Pope, who would have the audacity to reach out to the Pope? And Barbara Wilson setting up the meeting at Stanford, and Adrian reaching out to you know, Mayor Bloomberg. I mean, and everybody remembers Mayor Bloomberg gave the Sierra Club $50 million. We're willing to take a small fraction of that. But an example of that is down here in Texas this week that Ricky put on this big local conference, and that Kathy, with no staffing, in 2 weeks we're going to have a conference in Ottawa, a Canadian national conference, because people are thinking big. Okay, the couple more things we want to do. I want to have Steve read the U.S. actions. I'd like Kathy to read the Canadian actions, and then Lene and Ellie. So part of the actions this month is we're giving people a chance to both donate and reach out to friends and family members to donate to Citizens Climate Lobby. And we do have a letter that people can use to go to their friends and family. But like in all things, you know, in this organization, it's all about getting ourselves out on the skinny branches and doing what's uncomfortable. And certainly, for those of you who are ready, we want you to take it to the next level to actually call people. So Lene and Ellie are going to do that. So before I have Steve come on, let me also just say how excited we are for the groups that had Group Start workshops since last month's call, which includes in Washington State, Bellingham, Olympia, Tri-Cities, and Walla Walla, in Colorado, Roaring Forks, in Texas, El Paso, in Indiana, Bloomington, and in Missouri, Jefferson City, and Columbia, and also in Sweden, which Ellie did by Skype. So that was pretty cool. So anyway, Steve, are you there? All right, Kathy, you want to go first? Okay. Well,
can you hear me, Mark?
Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Kathy.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, so this month's actions in Canada are media hits. In November, there should be plenty of opportunities for media hits, given that there's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in Warsaw. A National Day of Climate Action has been called in Canada for Saturday, November the 16th. And an intrepid bunch of citizen climate lobbyists will be lobbying their MPs for a carbon tax. So we're encouraging our members to write letters to the editors using this month's Later Talks, submit the media release about Citizens Climate Lobby's first Canadian conference to your local media outlets, and call in and leave a message or submit online to your local radio stations our public service announcement for Canada's upcoming conference and lobbying days. And we're already getting members doing that. So that's really exciting that we're getting these radio hits across Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Way to go, Mississauga and Red Lake and other members that are doing this for us. And then in preparation for the lobbying days, please start practicing the 20 laser talks that our amazing interns here in Sudbury compiled and people across Canada wrote. Especially, I love Cheryl's number 20. And it has amazing data, especially to present to conservatives, but all of them are amazing. And I would like to just briefly say that I really like this month's call. There's 2 things that Canadians don't do very well. We tend to be polite, and there's 2 topics we tend to avoid, and that's politics and religion. And we'll be doing both of those this month. And not only that, at our conference in Ottawa on the Sunday morning, we're actually having a Christian service before the event starts. So our members can either go to the Christian service or they can meditate in meditation room. I'm married to a Hindu. Or they can do what's called meditation, which is also known as sleeping in. Anyways, I look forward to meeting everybody next month in Ottawa.
All right, good, Kathy. Thank you. Steve, are you there, or do you want me to read the U.S. app? Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Great, okay. So the actions for U.S. Groups this month, one would be to respond to the CCL fundraiser letter and ask others to consider supporting CCL with a contribution and or becoming active in our work. And the second action is schedule a meeting with your own faith leader, if you have one, pastor, rabbi, imam, whatever, to discuss what your faith has said about climate change and how you might activate and educate your faith community on that position. And then, of course, let's remember to try to schedule face-to-face meetings with our senators and representatives during the Thanksgiving recess.
Okay, Steve, crystal clear. Thank you. All right, Ellie and Lene, could you unmute yourself? So for some people, I'd like to, Lene, would you mind just calling Ellie as if you were going to call her and not just forward her the letter that we have in the action sheet, but call and say, I'd like to invite you to make a contribution or participate with CCL. Are the two of you there?
I'm here. This is Ellie.
Okay, go ahead, Lene and Ellie.
Ring, ring, ring. Hello, this is Ellie. Hi, Ellie, it's Lene. How are you?
Hi, Lene. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I was just calling in follow-up to the email I sent you a couple days ago about Citizens Climate Lobby. Did you happen to see that?
I saw it, but I really didn't have a chance to read it yet.
Okay. All right. Well, as I said in my note, I know that you're pretty concerned about climate change, and I am too, but I'm also feeling a lot more hopeful since I've joined CCL. This is such an incredible organization and group of people, and I'm hoping that you'll consider joining our work by either making a donation or checking out a CCL meeting with me sometime, or maybe even both. Would you be willing to do that?
Well, you know, with the kids being so little and everything, I just don't have much time to attend another meeting, but I think I might make a donation.
Okay, well, that would be really, really helpful. We're growing so much that we need help supporting our volunteers to make sure they can be just as effective as we've always supported them. So that would be really helpful. You can do that by check or credit card. You can respond to the link in the email. I can send that to you again, or you can go to our website. So it's really easy, and it's tax deductible. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. If you want to send that email to me again, that'd be great. Thank you, Lene.
Okay, thanks, Ellie.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks so much. Just giving you an example of how that call might go. I know for some of us that's really pushing the envelope of what we're comfortable with, but, you know, that's what this organization is all about, is all of us, you know, going out and doing the thing that was maybe last month was too uncomfortable, but this month we could reach out and do it. So then the last thing I'd like to say is what are you investing in if you invest in Citizens Climate Lobby? Well, you know, clearly there's the obvious. We started this year with 75 groups, and we have 141 now. And you all know because you participated in them, this isn't a, you know, you go on a website and you add your name and now you're part of a group. We have to come to the community and do a training. There's parts of it we can't do remotely, and there's always an expense that goes with things like that. So there's just the basic expense of running an organization and certainly running one that grows at the rate that we're growing. But here's the thing that I think you should be clear about if you have a chance, if you either you or your friends or family, if it works for you, it doesn't work for everybody, but if it works for you to contribute, what you're contributing to is what you cannot predict will happen when people will empower themselves. I don't think in any way we can predict what will happen when people will find out, rather than being shrunken and diminished and frightened about this issue, that they're empowered to be a match for it. So what happens? A humanities professor goes and talks to the World Bank. Amy calls the Pope. Barbara sets up a meeting at Stanford. Adrian says, yeah, I'll talk to Mayor Bloomberg. That sounds like someone I ought to be talking to. Ricky sets up a conference in Dallas, and Kathy puts on a conference in Canada. It really is about what happens not just with the people who are on this call right now when they're empowered and they find out they can do the biggest possible thing, but the other people who will come on. So when you're thinking about, or if it works for you to make a $10 a month donation or a one-time $1,000 donation or whatever works for you, what you're investing in is what we can't predict when people empower themselves, and that's something that I think it's worth you and I betting our money on. So everybody, thank you so much. I'm going to mute everybody's line. If you want to yell out a thank you to Eric for doing a great job of being our speaker this month, that would be great. I'll be unmuting everybody and coming back in 1 second.